As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
Hello, welcome to the Orsine and Chapman podcast on The Athletic. We're joined today by The Athletic's Adam Crafton and our Italian football writer, James Horncastle. Coming up today, we've got two exclusive. Firstly, David on his story that Liverpool are finalising a deal to sign RB Leipzig centre-half Ibrahim Konaté. Then James will tell us about his big interview with Mino Raiola and Jonathan Barnett, super agents to some of the biggest names in world football. We'll also continue our look at how the England squad is shaping up ahead of the Euros by talking about Chelsea's Mason Mount with The Athletic's Liam Toomey. Right now, you can subscribe to The Athletic for a special price of £3.99 a month for 6 months. That's 40% off the full price of a subscription. You'll get great analysis, in-depth features from our very best football writers and ad-free versions of all of the podcasts. Go to theathletic.com/Ornstein and Chapman and you'll be able to take advantage of this special 40% discount. theathletic.com/Ornstein and Chapman. First up then, David, a big exclusive transfer line from you this week as Liverpool move in on a new centre-half. One that isn't called Koulibaly by the looks of it, who appears to be linked with a move somewhere every 3 weeks in the media. So you've avoided Koulibaly. Who is it?
It had to be a centre-back beginning with K, didn't it, Mark? It's Ibrahima Konaté. Now, those in football and many fans who watch the Bundesliga closely and have seen his development, even those who have watched the French youth teams, if you're that obsessive, will know that Konaté is one of the most promising young centre-backs in world football. He is rated by many as being a better prospect than Upamecano, who we've talked loads about over the last year or so. He's 21 years old. He was being watched by most of the top clubs. Liverpool have been linked with him for a while, and our story reflects my information from speaking to a number of people that Liverpool have intensified their pursuit of him. They're really close to being able to do this. I think it's in its sort of final stages. It's not done. They need to still overcome a few hurdles, jump through a few hoops. There's the not insignificant, the crucial factor of the payment, which looks like it will have to be the release clause in the region of 40 million euros. I think it's possibly 41 to be precise. RB Leipzig are in a financial position that means that they don't need to negotiate or accept a lower fee, even though he's out of contract in the summer of 2022 and hasn't been playing so much recently. He has bit of a checkered injury record, which is something I'm sure we'll come on to speak about. But he's a prodigious talent. He's got all the attributes to be absolutely brilliant. Many people reacting to our story saying Liverpool have done it again. And if they manage to pull this off, it will be seen as a fantastic coup and something that over the course of the next decade, if it goes to plan, will be seen as great value for money, a bit of a bargain. He's got the physical and technical attributes to make a real success. He would appear to be just what Liverpool have been looking for, because we know they always had targeted the summer of 2021 to bring in a top centre-back. They hope to get through the January window without making any reinforcements, even after the injuries to Virgil van Dijk and Joe Gomez. They ended up doing this trolley dash that we've talked about before with Ozan Kabak and Ben Davis. But they're not a club who tends to knee-jerk and just throw cash at a problem. They have a grand plan, and it would appear among a number of options that Konate has risen to the top, and they'll try and get that deal done. But again, the normal caveats apply that these situations can change.
Are they in a race with other clubs for him? I mean, you mentioned he's been watched by most of the big clubs.
I don't think it's a race as such, because with a clause, everybody knows what they need to do, and then it will come down to a decision on his part. But I think Liverpool have stolen a march on those other clubs that were interested. There have been suggestions of Manchester United, of Chelsea, and various others. And from everything we're hearing, Liverpool have moved very swiftly to put themselves in pole position. RB Leipzig like to get their business done early as well. You've seen that with Upamecano going to Bayern Munich this summer. His replacement has been sourced in the form of Simakan. You have seen, or you may not have seen, that RB Leipzig have bought in a young centre-back by the name of Gvardiol from Dynamo Zagreb, an 18-year-old Croatian who is extremely highly rated. They've got a couple of German centre-backs there. They've got another French player who can sort of play central defence or right back. So this would seem to work out well for all parties. And if Liverpool decide to see this through, famous last words, but I don't think any potential rival interest will get close to it.
David, is there any chance that, I mean, if Liverpool don't get into the Champions League, would that affect the deal at all? Or is this something that happens as things stand, regardless of whether Liverpool are in the top four?
Well, the hurdles that were explained to me that still need to be overcome are things like medical to happen in due course, sorting out the financial situation. That potential equation had not come on my radar. And to be honest, a 21-year-old who, yeah, he's got Champions League experience, but he's not coming from one of the top clubs, like a Bayern Munich level, where you're here with somebody like David Alaba, he would only go to a club in Champions League football. That's not a factor that I think would make or break this deal. However, I guess it's something that could convince rivals to make an even stronger push and try and sell him a situation that they can offer, which Liverpool can't. However, the speed at which this deal is progressing, from what I hear, suggests that it could be done before we even find out if Liverpool are going to be playing Champions League football next season, in terms of agreeing or paying the clause, getting personal terms and medicals done. And then it would just be a case of registering him when the transfer window opens in early June.
What does this do for example, Kabak, who is on loan? They have the option to purchase Kabak. What will this do for quite a few of the centre-halves that are currently at Liverpool?
That's the big question, because you've got Van Dijk, Gomez, Matip, Kabak, Phillips, Williams, Davies. Obviously, Liverpool will hope that Van Dijk and Gomez and Matip make a full recovery. There's no specified date on their returns. Liverpool need to keep an eye on the contractual situation as well, for Van Dijk in particular. And, you know, they're returning from very serious injuries that present no guarantee of how quickly they will get back to their best, if at all. And so a centre-half, and James Pearce has written about this for The Athletic, would always have been on the agenda, maybe two. And that's where the Kabak situation comes into question. Do Liverpool pay the option, which is £18 million plus add-ons? I think they need to let Schalke know around mid-May. I don't know the exact date. Some people I speak to suggest that he will be sent back. Some people I speak to suggest he will be sent back and Liverpool will try to negotiate a lower fee than the option. Some people say that won't work because another team will come in and pay a higher fee for Kabak, who is impressed to an extent at Liverpool, 7 games on the trot, 90 minutes each, playing for Turkey, a very successful qualifying campaign so far for the World Cup, and he'll be going to the Euros. I really don't know if they're going to go for Kabak as well, but of course, he was not in the grander plan. It was a make-do signing that Liverpool very skillfully got on loan with an option rather than permanently in January. And then we don't know what's going to happen with the others outside of those premier names, such as Phillips, who's still under contract. He's done a good job, but we don't know the intentions. Davies hasn't played for Liverpool so far, and we don't know if he will. Will he be loaned out? Rhys Williams, will he go out on loan? So it could be a very different picture by the time next season kicks off. But the idea of being able to get somebody like Konaté is something that is surely too good to turn down.
This episode is supported by Season 3 of FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher division. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenges and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
So let's talk to our Italian writer, James Horncastle, next. This should be a belting chat over the next 15 minutes or so. There is a big interview on The Athletic with James, Daniel Taylor, Amina Raiola and Jonathan Barnett, which was done over Zoom, was it?
Yeah, it was done over Zoom once we could get Mino logged on, because I think he was accessing it by his phone. He kept dropping his phone, and in his first answer, there was all kinds of interference, so we had to start again. So as journalists, you're always kind of panicking, like, how much time have we got? But we ended up with like 90 minutes. And I don't think...
Wow!
I don't think Barnett and Riley have ever spoken at least publicly before. So to have that kind of access to them was illuminating. But I mean, for the first 20 minutes, I said to Danny afterwards that it was like a tennis match because we didn't get a word in edgewise. We were just going like this, just left, right, left, right, left, right, left, right, after one thing after another. So
before we get onto the chat, just the technicals of this, who sent out the Zoom meeting? Did that come from Mina Raiola, or did you send that out? And secondly, when somebody can't work Zoom, it is rather amusing. But do you let on how amusing it is to Mina Raiola, or are you understanding and trying to help him?
Look, I think we've all gone through Zoom hiccups. I don't think there's a Zoom call that doesn't go wrong in some capacity.
You're on mute, Mina. You're on mute. Get off mute, Mina.
But no, I mean, you know, these two guys have agencies. They have PAs who you kind of go through to set these sort of things up. So yeah, I think the interesting thing was Mino has, there's this myth about Mino that he's very punctual, that if you are 1 second late, that's too late for him and he's gone. He was late for this Zoom call. You know, so yeah. So his PA had to basically say, look, you know, Mr. Riley is coming, he's coming. And eventually he did come, and he was worth it. He was worth it. He was definitely box office.
What you probably didn't know, James, was that he was securing a deal for one of the biggest transfers of the summer just moments before switching onto your Zoom call. And I wanted to know, was the interference on his phone caused by the number of phones he presumably has?
Perhaps. I mean, there was all kinds of things going on around him. I mean, he kind of really kind of fit what you wanted from a kind of super agent, even though they don't like this. Yeah, I mean, he when he did join the call, he has these purple tinted glasses on. Yeah, he was just sort of, you know, going between phone calls and also had, you know, someone with bringing a bottle of water over. You know, he was clearly on the go. So yeah, it was good to tie him down. But I think having both him and Jonathan Barnett in the same Zoom call was fascinating because it was just one-upmanship. It was just one of them trying to get one over the other all the time. And the thing is, what you see is they're actually very good friends. So Raiola, who usually, you know, thinks nothing of sort of trash talking or sort of pulling his punches, he was quite happy to be Jonathan Barnett's punch bag every now and then to sort of let him get his punch lines off. So, I mean, that dynamic was very interesting to watch as well.
So there's no rivalry between them, certainly as regards this conversation. And did you find then that, I mean, we haven't even really got onto what you spoke to them about, but did you find that the two of them had quite a lot of common ground?
Yeah, a lot of common ground. I think in terms of being like two self-made guys who didn't have a background in football or being agents and yet have got to the top of their game, I think there's a lot of mutual respect there. I mean, Barnett did a €100 million transfer for Bale going to Real Madrid. Pretty soon afterwards, Raiola matched that with Pogba going back from Juventus to Manchester United. You know, Raiola says, you know, we've changed the economics of the game. I think in that sense, there is respect. Well, there is rivalry. I mean, Jonathan Barnett is very proud of having the top-ranked agency in the world. You know, however much stock you put in that Forbes list that comes out, I think Barnett's very proud of retaining his place at number one and likes reminding Mino about that three times a week. That's what he said. So I think they're aware that they're in this industry together. They are rivals, but it doesn't mean that they're not on a WhatsApp group between, you know, him and Jorge Mendes, the three of them. So I think that's it's pretty interesting. You know, Mino has set up this organization called the Football Forum. Barnett is the vice president. Jorge Mendes is the vice president as well. It's supposed to be a platform of bringing kind of football agents and football players together. But I think what really kind of comes across over the course of the interview, particularly the first 20 minutes, is Mino as this kind of Che Guevara kind of figure leading the revolution against FIFA. And I mean, in this respect, yeah, I mean, even Barnett's kind of laughing, saying he's El Presidente, he's El Capitan. You know, this is very much their thing. And so they are sort of campaigning, I suppose, against these reforms that FIFA are proposing, which are to re-regulate the football agent industry, because in 2015, I think at the end of Sepp Blatter's term, yeah, it was completely deregulated. So there's nothing to stop Mark Chapman, David Ornstein and Adam Crafton from becoming an agent. They don't have to take an exam in order to get a license. So
Jonathan Barnett will be seriously worried about that powerhouse of an organisation if the three of us teamed up. He won't be number one for very long.
Yeah, well, we've got El Chapitan.
So I mean, they are very strong on this. I mean, I don't think they are against regulation. They're not against having an exam. They're not against certain aspects of it. But I think what they are against is the idea that FIFA knows what's best for them. And they think this is all very deeply political. In the consultations that they've had, they think there isn't enough agent representation. So these rules for agents aren't written by agents. I mean, certainly Raiola. I mean, Barnett was a little bit more conciliatory, but certainly Raiola was making no secret of his desire to move away from football. So I suppose the last few weeks on this podcast, you'll have talked about a European Super League and the kind of maybe the threat to UEFA about that. Well, this is going on in the background as well, kind of football moving away from FIFA. What is FIFA for? I think that was very much what they wanted to get across in this interview.
Adam, do FIFA want to bring these guys down, the agents and especially the super agents?
I don't think they want to bring them down. I think they want to bring them down to size in some respects and have a level of control. And I don't, you know, I think I'm sure they were both very, very charming during this interview. But I think most of us have spent the last 15, 20 years saying, how can they get this much when they aren't the guys who are playing football and or coaching football? Why are they getting such a huge slice of the pie? And they will make the argument that, you know, they are big deal makers in big business industry. Raiola is amazing copy and completely compelling. James, do you get the impression from that conversation that readers or viewers will come away from this with huge sympathy for them, or empathy?
It's interesting what you're saying about them coming across as charming. There is a charm to them, but they're very combative. I mean, you can see why a player might want them in their corner, kind of in terms of like fighting for you know, for their negotiating position or whatever, they were very strong. To the point that it almost takes your breath away being in and amongst that. We put that to them. It's like, you're not going to get any sympathy, really. You know, when you look at the kind of commission fees that you've been getting. I mean, since agents were deregulated in 2015, I think in 2019, what FIFA recorded was there was the spike in commissions had gone up by a multiple of four to something like $659 million, something around that. And that was going to football agents. And of course, there is always this feeling that they are taking money out of the game. But yeah, they wanted to certainly try and correct that and say, look, you know, our agencies provide a service. You know, I think Barnett brings up the anecdote about the 1966 World Cup winning team here in England, about how many of those players had to sell their medals, had to sell their cups, some of whom are still working to this day because they weren't looked after by agents who could give them the kind of advice that would help them be set for life, help them get the kind of endorsement deals that would stave off that kind of financial insecurity. And yeah, I think they really feel that that is often missed in the media. And a lot of the stuff that we tend to only focus in the media on, the big commissions and the controversial statements, and not what they actually do in the background.
That's a really good point, because there's so many really good agents. There are some not so good ones, which I guess occurs in every industry. There is a majority of agents and players and people working in football that don't benefit from this sort of lavish level of income. It's kind of a relatively small elite, and that steals all of the headlines. We don't see this controversy about agents, facilitators, in pretty much any other sphere of life. Estate agents.
We definitely see it with estate agents.
Okay, but not to this extent. But I guess they don't get the same level of money. But in the artistic world and the other parts of the media and people making things happen, these go-betweens, football agents are just seen by many people as being scum of the earth. There is a bit of a balance to strike here.
It got too real at one stage when Mino said, like, you know, I mean, we are part of the entertainment industry now. And with that, just as if you're an agent of a big actor, you know, you would get a big commission. But as football has become part of the entertainment industry, it's like, you journalists, you know, without us, Saturday and Sunday, that's the only thing you write about. All the thing that goes around football now is almost what people are more interested in than the football itself. I mean, there's that Juan Malillo quote about, you know, sort of football, it was once the steak and now it's become the garnish. I mean, yeah, the steak is the transfer gossip. It's playing FIFA or sort of video gaming. And now that kind of 365-day life cycle that football has, that it's not just played once a week over 9 months, that it's 24/7 all day, every day. You know, in some respects, they are a part of that, and they are, I wouldn't say they're intentionally feeding it, but we're our kind of need for gossip, our need to know what's going on at our club all the time.
James, talking about the need for gossip, I'm sure listeners who support football clubs will be very keen to know if anything was said about any of Mino or Jonathan Barnett's major clients ahead of the summer. Did you get anywhere with that? Was there another episode in Paul Pogba-gate? We've gone several weeks on this podcast without mentioning Paul Pogba, so we have to mention him now.
The funny thing, Adam, was that I tried to make this joke, but the Zoom connection kind of failed, which was like, because Mino, ever since he made those comments about Pogba before what the Champions League game in December, which, you know, in fairness to him, if you want to defend him, he was making around the Golden Boy Award ceremony, which was being held in Turin, and Erling Haaland was going to become going to win that award. He said, yeah, English journalists are sensitive. So my joke was going to be, that's why I needed Danny Taylor with me, you know, so that, you know, there were at least two of us going up against Jonathan Barnett and Mino. But yeah, I mean, he struck a more kind of conciliatory tone about Pogba, really, in saying that he feels that Pogba is appreciated by people within the club, that he's appreciated by Solskjaer. In that sense, you know, it's maybe ex-players, it's maybe journalists are throwing kind of that whole debate and stoking it up all the time, which was interesting coming from him after he'd suggested that Pogba should leave. But, I mean, he didn't repeat that in our interview. I mean, he wanted to make a point about Sir Alex Ferguson, that they'd fallen out, and ultimately, you know, sort of Pogba going back to United proved that Raiola was right, that the club was right, and that Ferguson was wrong about Pogba.
Again.
And that was provoked, I must admit. Danny Taylor couldn't resist going down that avenue again. And then, of course, we spoke about Haaland. With Haaland, he admitted he feels that in hindsight, he was maybe too cautious with him in terms of taking him from Salzburg to Dortmund, because he thought that was the right intermediary stepping stone before going to a huge, huge club. But he thinks, you know, that Haaland is so ahead of his schedule that maybe that wasn't necessary, that maybe he could have gone from a Salzburg to, and these are names that I'm putting in his mouth here, Real Madrid, Manchester United, Barcelona, or whatever. He feels he's ready to do that now. And then again with Barnett, I mean, Barnett was very keen to say that he expects 4 or 5 record-breaking deals to be done by his agency this summer, which I think means, you know, maybe record-breaking for his agency rather than the industry as a whole, even though, I mean, surpassing what he did with Bale would be difficult. But certainly felt that the Premier League was in a very, very strong position to spend big this summer compared with clubs on the continent. That the TV deal means that the Premier League isn't necessarily recession-proof here, but there's still more money to go around in the Premier League and among Premier League clubs than there is in Serie A and La Liga especially.
That final point, Adam, is fascinating for me and many people listening to this, because there has been a narrative of there being no money to spend in football, full stop, including the Premier League. The same thing was said last summer. The clubs did end up spending, hoping they would recoup it through sales, and not many of them ended up doing so. Certain people saying it will be even worse this time round, but James there is presenting a slightly different picture. And when you look around the continent, and in particular in France, with their television catastrophe, really, the Premier League could have a really significant upper hand going into the next window.
I tell you what, one of the really interesting things that Raiola said, and this goes back to Haaland, I suppose, was that he will not send a young player to the Premier League. So, for example, a teenager or someone at the beginning of their career, let's say someone at Ajax who's just broken out, or someone, he would far prefer them to go to either to stay in Holland or to go to Germany than go to the Premier League or Serie A. Because he's like, in those leagues, managers have no time for young players. They have to, it's about winning now. It's about getting results. That's what you're judged on. You're never too far away from a crisis. Your job's never too far away from being on the line. I mean, you see it with United at Solskjaer, how that's gone up and down and up and down. And I think that was a kind of fascinating aspect in terms of like, yeah, I mean, he'd just done Brian Brobby, who's Ajax's latest star striker. He's gone to Leipzig, or he will be moving to Leipzig on a free transfer. And that was interesting, finding like, okay, well, why hasn't he maybe moved to a top Premier League team when his talent is already that highly regarded?
I think it's fascinating as well that I don't think people realise the extent to which Mino has just overtaken Holland. And the young talent in Holland. I mean, everyone talks about Mendes and Portugal, or Mendes and Spain, but Mino is really just sort of the majority of that Dutch under 21 setup and the youth system. He has really got a grip of it. We always look to Holland for young talent. So if that talent's going to be more likely to go to Germany or to Italy now, because of that's what Mino thinks, that's really significant insight, I think, going forward.
But also, that counteracts the it's all just about money. I mean, I know that obviously incredibly wealthy men, but what you've highlighted there, James, both with Haaland and with also Raiola's reluctance to send young players to the Premier League, is actually a care for his clients. Not. I mean, and maybe he is saying that because it's the whole PR exercise in an interview, but that it's not just about the money, that he actually is trying to build a career for these guys. In fact, if I was a player or the father of a player, there's a massive part of you that would want to be represented by Raiola.
Raiola makes this point. He says, I try to behave like a father to my players. And that doesn't mean telling them always what they want to hear. You know, that often means clashing with them and arguing with them. And I think one of the best lines that he gets, and this goes back to what Adam was saying about how much sympathy do you have for these agents. I think the most from this piece that you get is the care that they show for their players. And Raiola again says that, you know, he's not there to carry the players' bags. He wants to put something in the bag for the player. And that's not just money. That's experience. It's life.
Yeah.
That is all part of the service that he provides. Again, I think you'll get a real flavor in this piece about the dynamics and the decisions that agents make. You know, we really kind of drill down on when do you think is it the right time to move a player? And this was one of the really interesting moments when they both differed in their opinion. So Barnett, for example, said, you know, for example, big club comes in for my young player and I don't think he's ready. So I tell him, you know, you maybe need to stay another year, at Aston Villa or something. Let's say Jack Grealish. He didn't say this, but I'm going to use it as an example. And Mino says, well, if you stay on another year and you'd say turn down a Manchester United or a Real Madrid, that player could easily do his cruciate ligament that year. And that opportunity might never come again. So how do you make that decision? And I think seeing that dynamic and how they basically go through that with their clients was one of the really interesting aspects.
On the flip side of the sort of more popular narrative, you've touched upon it there. These players are signing up with these agencies. If they were so bad, if they were so treacherous, why would this stream of talent continue to go to them and even the biggest talents stay loyal to them? They obviously feel that they're doing a great job representing their interests, helping further their careers. It doesn't always go right. You do see some players move around. I think Romelu Lukaku left Mino Raiola, but there's loyalty there. They're also not the only people taking money out of football. Where's the money going to a chief executive of a football club? That's not being reinvested into the game. So, you know, it suits these clubs, Adam, to slam the agents when they're not doing what they would like them to be doing. But they equally love the agents when they're bringing them players. And it's quite a tricky dynamic.
It is. And it's funny, you never hear about agents taking money out of Hollywood or agents taking money out of the music industry or out of the BBC when they get an actor at a gig. But, I think it's that kind of puritanical view of football. You know, there's still a sort of nostalgia for how football used to be, but also how football used to be was footballers not being particularly well paid. You know, if you go back to, as James was saying, about the 1966 set of players, not being particularly well safeguarded, not having an efficient union, and agents give them those protections. I differ slightly on, you know, agent players go with agents because, you know, they're always representing them well. I think a lot of young players go with agents for the cachet of the social cachet of being able to say, much like I have a Nike deal or an Adidas deal, I have an agent. It means I'm going somewhere and I'm going to have a proper career. And it's almost a rite of passage. It's like, you know, you can't get, it's like, you know, most people in the UK, a lot of people in the UK now can't get an interview for a job without going to university, but do they actually need the degree? And it's a bit like that with agents. You don't need an agent to sign for Man United, but it's going to help you get through the door. And that will be the case at clubs around the country. So yeah, they do represent them well, but they're not without flaws. And we still hear, you know, we hear horror stories about, you know, the amount of information that agents provide about tax. And it goes beyond sort of just recommending clubs. It's, you know, it's a whole, they call, you know, holistic 360 vision for a footballer.
I would like to say that I do have an agent and I'm going absolutely nowhere. We can hear a clip of Mino Raiola and Jonathan Barnett from James and Daniel's interview. Here it is.
When Ferguson criticised me, was my biggest compliment ever anybody could give me. Because Ferguson is used to people come in, especially with young boys, and then they say, yes, sir, yes, sir, yes, sir, yes, sir. And I only have to say that when Ferguson left, his owner, by buying back Paul Pogba, told me that was, by doing that, he told me that I was right. Because I didn't want to take Paul Pogba away. He didn't believe in Paul Pogba. When Ferguson says, I don't like him, it's the biggest compliment that I could have. It's like saying Blatter says, I don't like him. Fantastic. I don't care what Ferguson says.
I think it's much more worrying if a player came out and said something against Mina.
Okay, James, thanks very much for that. Honestly, absolutely fascinating. Thank you for doing that. And you can head to The Athletic to read that piece in full. See you soon, James.
Yes.
Cheers, guys.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
That was a really worrying time being a Rangers fan, not knowing if you'd have a team to support or not.
The Scottish Football League's only acceptable position will be to place Rangers FC into the third division.
It wasn't so much a football match you were involved in as a test of manhood.
And with your support along the way, we will get back to where we belong.
From the bottom to the top, the journey is over. Rangers are back.
It all ended spectacularly in Europe when he had an argument with Rangers fans in a bush.
It's a huge, huge honour for me to be sat here now to be the manager of Rangers. And, you know, the excitement levels are very difficult to contain at the moment.
Drilled by Arfield, Connor Goldson looking to score again, and he has scored again, and Rangers are in such a good place now.
Everybody in Scotland was talking about 10 at the start of the season, and the only number they're now talking about is 55.
To get the full story of the fall and rise of Rangers, subscribe now to Beyond the Headline.
Right, finally on the pod this week, it's time for On the Plane, a weekly feature with the nonsensical title, looking at how the England squad is shaping up ahead of Euro 2020. Steady performance on Sunday for England, beating Albania. Mason Mount, one of the standout performances. The Athletic's Chelsea writer Liam Toomey joins us. Does it feel like Mason Mount is now validated by recent performances? He was always seen as a teacher's pet of both Southgate and Lampard, and the perception, rightly or wrongly, appears to have changed in the last month or so, maybe 2 months.
I think now you have to look at him as a teacher's pet for every coach that he plays for. I think he's just increasingly carving out a reputation as a player that coaches love, because he, in addition to the quality that he brings on the ball and the versatility that he offers positionally, he's just got all the intangible things that coaches really want. You know, he's got the, you never have to worry about his intensity or his determination on any given day, because it's always at the absolute max. And he always sets the tone for the team with and without the ball. And so I think it's very easy to see why Southgate likes him. He got tied up in the whole culture war around Lampard within the Chelsea fan base, which wasn't his fault. No more than it was for Jorginho under Maurizio Sarri before him. There always seems to be one player at the heart of all of this who ends up being the lightning rod. But Mount, I think, now is well positioned to be a pillar of Chelsea for years to come. And if recent performances are anything to go by, you know, a pretty solid building block for England as well.
He's not only on the plane, I would argue he's in the starting 11, whatever formation Southgate comes up with.
Yeah, I mean, Southgate seems to have a very similar opinion of him to the one Lampard did, which is it doesn't necessarily matter where I get him into the team. I just have to get him into the team. He seems to have a greater level of trust for Mount than someone like Jack Grealish or James Maddison, other players who are very, very talented in similar positions. But Mount just seems to be ahead of them right now in Southgate's thinking. So, I think that's very true. I think as long as he stays healthy, which he has been so far, the only concern you'd have about Mount at this point is just the sheer amount of football he's played this season. If anything, his coaches like him too much. Lampard wouldn't even rest him in the FA Cup. So as long as he maintains his energy levels and he never ever seems to get tired, he never seems to be out for very long, even when he tweaks an ankle here or there, then he should be a key part of what England are doing at the Euros.
Yeah, fitness permitting, Adam, it doesn't seem like anybody else in the squad offers what Mount does, and that makes him, for me, a near guaranteed starter.
I think in Southgate's mind, for sure, because I think what Mount gives you is almost this guarantee of at least 7 out of 10. And I think maybe a Grealish, he's either, he could be a nine, but he might also be a 5.5 or a six. That Aston Villa fans will probably be screaming at that suggestion. But I think Mount gives you that base level that is probably higher than perhaps Maddison or Grealish. I think that's the way Southgate's viewing it. Because I think Southgate's starting to, you know, he's insisting, isn't he, on this almost double pivot in midfield. And I think that that is built around, you know, people will say last night, oh, why doesn't he take the handbrake off against Albania? Well, I think he's trying to devise a system that can not only work against Albania, but can also enable England to get a result if they come up against Spain or Portugal or France when it really matters in the summer. And I think that that will mean playing in a slightly more defensive mindset, because I don't think we've necessarily got the centre-halves and the goalkeeper to cope with having a really top-heavy team. And there might be a lot of people who are upset by that. Their favourite player might not be on the pitch. It might mean Phil Foden doesn't start. It might mean Jack Grealish doesn't start. It might mean James Maddison isn't in the squad. But I think that's the way Southgate is thinking. And, you know, ultimately that will mean he's very much judged on results, because the performances probably won't be as invigorating as they would be with all that talent on the pitch.
Just one other thing to add on kind of what Mount brings to a team. I think with pressing being so important in modern football and so central to what coaches are doing at the top level, I think that aspect of Mount's game is perhaps what coaches like most about him. That Lampard knew he could rely on Mount to lead the Chelsea press. Tuchel knows the same. That's why I think that's part of the reason why he's played him a lot in what he calls the high positions in that front three, because he knows that Mount will be able to put defenders under pressure. And he just never, ever stops. He never slows down. He never gives his opponents breathing space. And when he is close, he is tenacious enough to make tackles and create turnovers and make things happen. So I think that's a big, big part of Mount's game that maybe people don't talk about enough. They focus on occasionally his decision-making can be a little bit erratic. He's not always got the finishing touch. He can be a little bit frustrating to watch at times because of that. But I think when you consider what he gives the team without the ball, the whole package is very appealing to any coach who can call upon him.
Liam, we talked on here last week about Southgate favouring trust over necessarily form or reputation specifically. And I think that trust extends off the pitch with his selections as well. There has been this sort of whisper within football that he has had moments where he's not been so keen on Grealish and Maddison related to, I don't know, off-field stuff, publicity, the way their image has been portrayed. Whether or not that's true, and we saw the incident with Phil Foden in Iceland as well, but it appears that Mason Mount is sort of squeaky clean in that sense. Is his whole sort of on and off field persona surrounds an important factor in this as well?
If that is the case, if Southgate is taking those factors into mind, then it's easy to see how that would be another thing in Mount's favour, because, you know, no one on this earth is whiter than white. We all have imperfections and flaws, but he certainly lives a very quiet life off the pitch. I mean, we all do right now, but he generally seems to be all about football all the time. And all the stories you hear coming out about him at Cobham are the kind of things you used to hear about John Terry and Frank Lampard, about his approach to training, first in, last out. And his general commitment. There was a nice story in the piece that Simon Johnson wrote for us on Mount in the last few days, where he spotted some academy boys eating in a cafe in Cobham in the village, and just kind of snuck in and paid the bill without them realizing and walked out. You know, so there are lots of little things like that that I think are creating a very, very positive image of Mount off the pitch as well as on it. And it's easy to see why, if Southgate is taking these things into mind and kind of prioritising a sort of holistic approach to his squad, it's very easy to see why Mount would fit very snugly into that.
I know you said that every player kind of gets, oh, there's always one player that gets that reaction, and you mentioned Jorginho with Sarri. But actually, when we talk about Mason Mount, it must have been only a minority of Chelsea fans who might have had that reaction towards him. And what in particular was he getting criticised for? What wasn't he doing that was annoying Chelsea fans at that stage?
Yeah, I think it's always really hard to put your finger on just how many people are saying this, because social media tends to amplify the people that are shouting the loudest and saying the most extreme things. So you will get the most extreme backers of Mount and the most extreme critics on Chelsea Twitter. That's just the nature of it. You certainly didn't see anything really when stadiums were full of frustration with Mount in stadiums, because I think he's the kind of player that when you're at a game, you immediately warm to, because you can see the effort in everything that he does. But the things that I think have been leveled at him, and some of them are, you know, are justified because they're football criticisms. He can be a bit erratic and a bit flawed with his decision-making in the final third. He can shoot from maybe slightly optimistic angles. He can kind of get tunnel vision at times and not make the passes he needs to make. But I think that's all part of being a younger player as well. You don't expect a player to come into a team at Chelsea after a year of championship football and a year on loan in Holland and just be able to make the right call with the ball, leading a counter-attack every single time. And the other element I think had less to do with him and more the fact that Lampard just picked him every single game. And I think you had some fans who, you know, everyone has their own favourite player. That favourite player varies depending on who you are. Some people love Callum Hudson-Odoi. Some people love this season Hakim Ziyech, Kai Havertz. And all these fans want to see their favourite player play. And a lot of them kind of became united in frustration that Mount was consistently being played ahead of these guys, regardless of position, even when it was out wide, where even Mount would admit, you know, that's not his best role.
Two-part question for you all to finish, and each part is just yes or no. First part, and yeah, Liam, you go first. Does he start England's first game at the Euros?
Yes, I'm inclined to say yes.
And if England don't win that first game and he keeps out Foden or Grealish, is there then a clamour for Foden or Grealish to start ahead of him in the second game?
Yeah, most likely, but I can also see Southgate being stubborn and sticking with him.
Okay. David, does he start the first game?
Fitness permitting, absolutely.
And again, if England lose that first game, is there then a clamour for Foden or Grealish to replace him?
A massive clamour. And knowing Southgate, he's strong enough to stick with Mount. But if Foden, Sancho have good ends to the season, then it might be too difficult to resist pulling Mount out and bringing one of them in.
Adam, first one, yes or no?
Yeah, well, I don't subscribe as much as the other guys in terms of like he has to start. I mean, talking a bit like he's sort of the English Messi at this point, as in like, you know, we can't do without him. We've got a load of great players in that position. I don't think it would be unreasonable if Southgate decides based on form towards the end of the season that Sancho or Grealish or Rashford or Sterling or Foden. I mean, the idea of us not playing Foden is very sad to me. I quite like the idea of having both Mount and Foden in the team. Not sure how you do it, but for sure. If they start in that sort of quite regimented 4-2-3-1 and Mount is the number 10 and it goes wrong in the first game, he will take heat. And he will take heat because it's the key position in that team, and people will be looking to that position to make things happen.
That was a good yes-no answer.
Yeah, I know, yeah. Well, it combined both of them together, didn't it, really, I suppose. We'll have more on the plane on next week's pod and on the Athletics YouTube channel. Liam, thanks for joining us, and that's it. Thanks for listening. We're back here next week, and I'll be back on Thursday with Matt Slater for the Business of Sport podcast. Bye for now.
The Athletic.